Everyone can please take their seats. We'll be getting our program underway momentarily. Thank you for joining us for lunch this afternoon. I'm Henry Olson, Vice President at the American Enterprise Institute, and I'm glad to be able to say that the American Enterprise is pleased to co-sponsor this event with the John Templeton Foundation to help improve the quality and the quantity of the discourse with respect to an ever-burgeoning topic in the public mind and the public square, which is the relationship between science and religion. The Templeton Foundation is long noted and, in fact, dedicated to exploring the intersection between these worlds and have a number of interesting fellowships and publications and grants that have served to explicate and further the debate in these areas. And one of the topics which they have wanted to pursue and one of the methods they wanted to use is to engage a number of leading scientists and thinkers on various questions with respect to these intersections. Today's event pertains to the most recent of the publications and advertisements in this series, and it directly addresses the question, does science respect or necessary make belief in God obsolete? We'll be hearing more about this from Gary Rosen, who is the chief external affairs officer at the Templeton Foundation. Gary comes to that job in which he is the primary person in charge of publicizing the Templeton Foundation's efforts to the world at large as opposed to the academic community. And he comes to that position from many years in journalism as a top editor at Commentary Magazine, and previous to that an editor at the Manhattan Institute City Journal Magazine. He holds a PhD in government from Harvard University, and also served as a speechwriter to former New Jersey Governor Thomas Kane. So please join me in welcoming Gary, and he can tell you about today's event.
Great. Thanks, Henry. It's very good to be here. We appreciate AEI's generous hospitality. As most of you probably know, the John Templeton Foundation is primarily concerned with funding research, research on what we like to call the big questions. So our grant making focuses on fields like cosmology, theoretical physics, evolutionary biology. We also support a great deal of work in the cognitive and social sciences. Because we at the Foundation think that a full picture of the human experience must draw on many different sources, we also like to bring together scientists and philosophers and theologians to talk about the most profound issues in their fields and to see where their interests might overlap. Our session today is part of the Foundation's Big Questions campaign, an effort to go public with this approach. As all of you know, as all of us know too well, whenever questions about the relationship between science and religion show up in the public square, there's a tendency toward polarization. The various ideological camps quickly take to the barricades, and very seldom do any of us emerge any wiser for that. Our Big Questions campaign is an effort to raise the discussion to a higher plane, to make it more civil, more informed, and we hope more illuminating for everyone on all sides. We asked 13 distinguished scientists, scholars, and commentators to address this provocative question, does science make belief in God obsolete? The result is the booklet, which I hope all of you have in your hands by now. More copies of this, by the way, can be ordered online free of charge at templeton.org. The response to this big question, which has been advertised in print media, radio, online, has really been remarkable. We've had well over 400 comments posted to our website. It's been widely discussed in the blogosphere, and we've had, I think now, close to 2,000 requests for this booklet. So it seems to have struck a chord out there, and that pleases us a great deal. To continue the discussion today, we're fortunate to have not only our two distinguished guests, Michael Shermer and Bill Phillips, who have essays in the booklet, but also our moderator, Michael Novak, who holds the George Frederick Jewett Chair in Religion, Philosophy, and Public Policy here at AEI. A proper introduction for Michael would take up the better part of our hour, so let me try to give you some highlights. He has taught at Harvard, Stanford, and other top universities. He has served as an outstanding and effective U.S. ambassador, especially on human rights issues, and I'm proud to say he is a winner of the Templeton Prize, awarded in 1994 for his pioneering work on the theology of freedom and free markets. The latest of his many, many books is due out this summer. It is called No One Sees God, The Dark Night of Atheists and Believers. I've been reading an advanced copy of this book, and it's a typical Michael Novak performance. It is eloquent, learned, and eager to engage all sides in a spirit of inquiry and mutual respect. We are very fortunate to have him to preside over our discussion today. Michael Novak.
Thank you all very much. We would like to conduct this as much as we can as a conversation, in part in fulfillment of a general thesis that this is a subject that ought to be a subject of conversation among reasonable people. And passions get aroused, but passions get aroused about all sorts of important things. My father once told me, Michael, never argue about religion or politics. He said, everybody gets emotional and you can't reach any conclusion. After a little while, I began to think there must be a career in that. Well, let me jump right away to introducing participants in our conversation here, and then I will engage them for a short while back and forth and then turn it over to you, hoping you might have questions to contribute to the conversation. Let me start with Michael Shermer, who is a monthly columnist for Scientific American, which is a wonderful place to appear and on a regular basis, the founding publisher of Skeptic magazine, the executive director of the Skeptic Society, and the host of the Skeptic's Distinguished Science Lecture Series at the California Institute of Technology. He's an adjunct professor of economics at Claremont Graduate University, and he's written many books. The Mind of the Market is one of them. Compassionate Apes, Competitive Humans, and Other Tales from Evolutionary Economics. Why Darwin Matters, The Case Against Intelligent Design, and, nice title here, Science Friction, Where the Known Meets the Unknown. Professor Phillips is the Nobel Prize winner in physics in 1997, which he shares with two others, whose name I will mention as I go along, for experiments using laser light to cool and trap atoms. 20 years earlier, Dr. Phillips had joined the staff of the National Bureau of Standards, now the National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, where he conducted his award-winning research. Building on the work of one of his colleagues, he developed new and improved methods for measuring the temperature of laser-cooled atoms. Then, in 1988, he discovered that the atoms reached a temperature 6 times lower than the predicted theoretical limit. That's always satisfying when when you knock out a theory. With one of his colleagues, Dr. Cohen Tanuji, he refined the theory to explain the new results, and then he and Dr. Phillips further investigated the methods of trapping atoms cooled to even lower temperatures. His other colleague in this work, who helped start him on this, was Stephen Chu, the two of them share the prize with him. He's currently a distinguished university professor at the University of Maryland and the fellow at the Joint Quantum Institute a cooperative venture of the university in NIST. Well, I'm happy to welcome all of you to the conversation. I thought it might make sense to begin by asking each of our participants to describe briefly or give the highlights of their little contribution to the booklet that was just introduced to us from the Templeton Foundation. Why don't I ask you, Dr. Phillips?
Thank you very much, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to be with the two Michaels. Reading the things that you've written about this subject really makes me feel that we can have a really good conversation about this and really help to generate more light than heat. So I and other people who responded to this question obviously took it in very different ways. Some people responded, well, no, science doesn't make belief in God obsolete, but it certainly should, and there's just no accounting for what people will believe. And I believe that this is one of the points that that Michael Shermer has made in some of his writing, is that there's no accounting for what people believe. I took a rather different attitude. I took it to ask, what do I believe? And so I gave a very personal response to the question, and my answer was, absolutely not. And I even put an exclamation point after the absolutely not. And the reason I responded in this way, and an idea that I tried to develop in the short essay, was that I see two aspects of modern thinking, both of which I wanted to argue against. On the one hand, you have scientists or people who speak from a scientific perspective saying that religion is an outdated superstition, and that the understanding of modern science basically makes it that we do not need God to explain the kinds of things that are now explained by science. And on the other hand, you have deeply religious people who believe that the teachings of science are an attack on their religion, and that they see this as being something rather evil to be resisted at all costs. And what I wanted to do is to express the idea that neither one of these points of view represents either the typical opinion of scientists or of people of faith, and there are very good reasons for that, and that in an age of science, when you have explanations for many of the phenomena of the universe that in past days were ascribed to supernatural causes, that in such a time that there is still room for a very deep and personal belief in God that does not have to do at all with the idea that there are some things that we cannot explain and therefore must appeal to God in order to explain them, but rather has to do with the fact that there is something besides science as a way of looking at the world. And that was what I tried to express in my essay, that science and faith were two different kinds of things, both perfectly valid and useful ways of looking at our world, not completely separate, but not really addressing in general the same kinds of questions.
Thanks. You
want to
do
the same way? Sure. Well, thank you, Michael, and thanks to Gary Rosen for allowing me to edit the essays in this booklet and participate in one. My position in brief, I guess, is that it helps distinguish between belief and God. And the question, does science make belief in God obsolete? My answer is it depends. It depends whether we're talking about belief or God. The fact that something like 95% of Americans believe in God, and the last survey showed 39% of members of the AAAS working scientists in America believe in God, which replicated James Luba's 1916 study of a similar data set that found 40% of Americans, scientists, working scientists, believe in God. So obviously the answer is no, science doesn't make belief in God obsolete unless 40% of working scientists are all idiots or something. Obviously it doesn't change and alter beliefs necessarily. But that's separate from the empirical question, if it could be an empirical question, is there actually a God or not? Whether you believe in it or not, the question still remains, is there actually a God out there somewhere? So to the extent that you take it seriously as a scientific question, that is there some way we can test this hypothesis, run an experiment or collect data and reject the null hypothesis that there is no God based on some confidence level of the data? This, of course, is what the intelligent design advocates want to do. They want to argue it is an empirical question. It's a testable scientific hypothesis, and they think they can run the experiment and that they have, and that you can conclude there is an intelligent designer based on things like the structure of DNA and the bacterial flagellum and things like that. But even if you don't buy the intelligent design argument, in principle, they're on the right track if you think that there's something that science can say about God in some empirical, thoughtful way, or do you just chuck it entirely? So one way I came at this was mostly tongue-in-cheek on the title. I call it Shermer's Last Law because I don't think you should name laws after yourself, and the first shall be last and the last shall be first, so I can quote the Bible, see. Anyway, and it is this: any sufficiently advanced extraterrestrial intelligence is indistinguishable from God. That is, if you just take you take the difference between biological evolution and cultural evolution and the incredibly rapid speed with which cultures and technologies and science develops compared to the glacially slow change in evolution, if we were to encounter an extraterrestrial intelligence somewhere, the chances of them being at the exact same level we're at, which is, by the way, what all the ufologists think. They think, you know, the aliens landed at Roswell in 1947 and gave us transistor technology, just slightly better than vacuum tubes. Wow. The chances of aliens being just, you know, like a few years ahead of us is virtually zip, because the chances of finding them are pretty slim anyway, and if we did, they're either going to be way behind us and not sending radio signals in spacecraft, or they'll be way ahead of us. And by the way, parenthetically, whatever the aliens look like, they're not going to be bipedal primates with gnarly stuff on their forehead speaking English with an Indian accent. That's largely driven by wardrobe budgets of television and film. So whatever we encounter, they won't be anything like us, and they won't be anywhere remotely close to us technologically, scientifically, and so on. And how far ahead of us would they be? Well, this is the kind of question SETI scientists like to deal with. But on the order of magnitudes of hundreds of thousands or millions of years ahead of us, most likely. And look what we've been able to accomplish in just 50 years from discovering the structure of the genome, or actually that there is such a thing as a deoxyribose nucleic acid, so all the way to J. Craig Venter's construction of an artificial genome within the last few months. Just half a century, just 50 years. Think of what an advanced extraterrestrial intelligence would be able to do in 50,000 years of technology. They could surely construct not just entire cells, but entire life forms. And if the sci-fi people and theoretical physicists like Freeman Dyson are right, it's only a matter of time before you could reconfigure interstellar gas to collapse into stars and create solar systems and planets. And possibly even, if you want to take this way out, say millions of years of advanced technology, cause stars to collapse into black holes. And if it's true that universes are created out of the infinite singularity of a collapsing black hole, perhaps an advanced technological race could even create universes. So what would we call an extraterrestrial being capable of creating cells, advanced life forms, planets, solar systems, and universes? Well, if you don't know the technology, well, it looks like a god. If you do, then it's just like us, but more. So anyway, the long story short is I can't think of any scientific experiment you could possibly run or any search we could possibly do that could find you anything other than an advanced extraterrestrial intelligence, just sufficiently more advanced than us, it seems godlike, but would not be something on the order of what traditional mainstream religions think of when they think of an omniscient, omnipotent being. And therefore, you're still stuck in the natural world, and any discovery would just become then part of the natural world. And therefore, what place for God?
Do you think that it matters very much whether science can show that there's a God? I mean, if science shows something, it's got to be in part matter. And it's got to be subject to empirical testing. And so a lot depends when you're looking, what you're looking for. Mm-hmm. It's like the drunk who is searching under the street lamp in Rome for a silver dollar he has dropped. And the cop comes along and asks him, what's he looking for? And he said, a silver dollar. He said, where did you lose it? He said, down the street. And why are you looking up here? There's more light up here, he says. Well, you know, it's important to place the questions. What do you think about that?
Well, it doesn't matter to me, but it matters to a lot of people, and that's in part what's driving the science and religion debate, is that there's a lot of religious people that want to use science to bolster religious beliefs. That's all fine and good if you don't make it dependent on that. If you hook your religious faith to certain specific arguments, gaps in our scientific knowledge, what are you going to do with your faith when the gaps are filled, which they inevitably are, or they just disappear? So, for example, let's take something slightly less controversial, but something we deal with in Skeptic Magazine, is psychic power, the ability to read minds, things like that. Let's say it turns out that people can actually do this, although it doesn't look like they can, but let's say they can. And let's say it turns out that this theory held by a physicist and an anesthesiologist, that the way it works is that inside neurons are these little microtubules that are like the scaffolding of the cell, and inside the microtubules are these little vacuum states in which the collapse of the wave function can occur in some sort of pattern wave. If you're thinking thoughts, and if all of us in the room right now think of a certain thought, like let's think peace or something like this, and get all of us to sort of get this thing going. And that somehow we cause the collapse of the wave function in all our neurons to happen in a pattern, and we cause some sort of effect in the physical environment. We cause peace to break out or something like that. This is the Maharishi's idea. You get the square root of 1% of the world's population to meditate at the same time, cause world peace. Anyway, it hasn't worked so far, apparently. But let's say it turns out that's true, and we now understand the quantum physics of telekinesis and psychic power. That's no longer the paranormal. Now that's just whatever you'd call it, neurophysics or quantum neurotelephysics or whatever. It would just become part of the natural world. So I can't conceive of, let's say it turned out that prayer does affect healing, distant healing on people you don't know. Let's say that turned out to be true. And thanks to the Templeton Foundation, actually, for funding the biggest study that showed it isn't true. But let's say it turned out to be true. That one, then, once we understood the mechanism by which we all think a certain thought about somebody getting better from their cancer or heart disease, and they actually do, and we then figured out the quantum physics behind it or whatever's happening when you think thoughts and it goes over there and affects cells and so forth, that would just become part of medicine, some kind of like immune system, psychoneuroimmunology, something like this. It would just become part of the natural world. That wouldn't be religion. That wouldn't be part of faith. That wouldn't be part of the supernatural. It would just be incorporated into science. And that's the fate of all these kinds of claims. They're either incorporated into science as something we understand, or they're just not part of it at all.
You want to speak a little bit, Michael?
Sure.
Bill.
Sure. Well, I agree with what Michael Shermer has said. I don't believe that one should base one's faith on gaps in knowledge because, in fact, they are always filled in. Well, that's not the reason you shouldn't do it. The reason you shouldn't do it is because it's just a bad idea. But but one of the reasons it's a bad idea is because those gaps are always filled in. And sure enough, if your God is someone who is subject to scientific investigation, then your God is just matter and energy. And I agree, nothing separate from what is studied by science. I think where we differ is that I believe that there is something extremely valuable to be understood that is, in fact, outside of science. And I don't think that faith is the only example of such things. I think there are plenty of things that we all affirm as part of our daily lives that we don't treat scientifically, that we shouldn't treat scientifically, and we certainly don't want to treat scientifically. It may very well be that a lot of aspects of our personal relationships can be understood in terms of biochemistry and neurology, but I don't think any of us on a moonlit walk with a loved one want to think of it just that way. And so I think that we are all comfortable with the idea that there's plenty of things in our lives that we will deal with outside of the scientific paradigm. And while I think faith is a particularly important part of our lives that we should deal with outside of the scientific paradigm, it's certainly not the only one.
What's it like for you and those others, a minority, but a small minority of scientists, according to these studies, that both are believers, and in part of their lives, and at the same time function as physicists or biologists?
Well, it's not such a small minority. As Michael pointed out, there's this 40% number which keeps coming up from the beginning of the 20th century to the end of the 20th century, that on the order of 40% of working scientists answered yes to questions that were quite rigorous. For example, I don't remember the exact phrasing of the question, but maybe you can help me. People were asked, do you believe in a God to whom you could pray with an expectation of an answer? Now, that's not Einstein's God. That's not Spinoza's God. That's a very tough definition. A lot of scientists complained. They said, well, gee, if you'd broadened your definition of God a little more, then I could have answered yes to that. But no, the idea was to ask the same questions at the end of the 20th century that they asked at the beginning of the 20th century to get consistent results. So this is a hard definition of God. So 40% is not a very small number, and had the definition been broadened, there would have been a higher percentage of people who would have answered yes. But to get to your question, how does that work? Well, it works just the same way as anything else works. I'm a scientist. I also love my wife and my children, and I also enjoy music and art, and these are things that I approach in a way that I don't think about my scientific way of thinking when I approach these kinds of things. I don't see a conflict. I don't see, for example, that because I read the Bible and I read in Genesis that the earth was created in 6 days, I don't see this as conflicting with my understanding of the way in which cosmology has developed, and the earth is in fact 14 billion years old, and that the evolutionary process is the way in which all of the different species that we see today have come to be. I don't see it as a conflict, because I don't see that literal meaning of Genesis as being the important meaning. The things that I take as being important from Genesis are the constant repetition, and God saw that it was good. The idea that creation is, in fact, just that. It is the work of God rather than God itself, as perhaps more primitive forms of religion had thought, that creation itself was God. But the perhaps radical idea of the Hebrew Scriptures were that the world was the creation of God rather than being God itself. So these are the important lessons that I learned from the Scriptures, and I don't see the package in which those lessons come as being the important part. That package I think of as being poetry and metaphor, and in a sense it makes the message even stronger, because poetry is capable of conveying even stronger messages than prose. But I don't see the conflict there. So when you ask me, how does it work? Well, I don't. It's not that big of a problem.
You have Jay Gould's view of the two magisteri. I don't like the word magisteri.
Yeah. So Stephen Jay Gould said, well, science and religion are non-overlapping magisteria. Each of them goes into their own little box, and never shall there be any connection between them. The answer is not quite. For me, it's a very neat little package to say. Then I don't have to talk about the question of science and religion at all, because they never have anything to say to each other. Well, that's not quite right, because after all, science has to inform the kinds of choices we make in a religious context. So how could somebody trying to make moral choices in the context of their religious understanding ignore what science has told us? On the other hand, fundamentally, I think that science and religion ask different kinds of questions. Science asks us asks and attempts to answer questions about how do things work, how did things come to be the way they are, whereas religion asks and answers questions, how should we behave to each other? I don't think science has good answers to that. Although science, once we've decided what kind of results we want, science may be able to help us to decide what the details are about how we should go about doing that.
Well, I want to hit this point a little harder, that it seems to me, Bill, gap-filling. So we don't need God anymore for explaining the origins of the solar system, and it didn't happen 6,000 years ago. Okay. That's poetry from Genesis, something like that. Okay, so, but we still need God to evoke, what, aesthetic appreciation of a sunset, love between two people, and poetry. Why do we need God to explain those things? I mean, we have perfectly good explanations for why people are nice to one another. We know all about oxytocin and dopamine systems that cause social primates to attach and bond to one another in reciprocal exchanges. We know about attachment theory and how family members and genetic relations are deeply attached to one another through these evolved brain mechanisms. Now, that doesn't detract at all from the appreciation emotionally you have, but even emotions can be studied scientifically. Why should we have emotions at all? I mean, what's the purpose of feeling guilty about hurting somebody's feelings? Well, because in a social primate species, if you violate social norms a lot, you're not a good, reliable group member. We can't really trust you. And therefore, the sense of guilt or on one side or joy and pride on the other side of having done the right thing. These are evolved emotions that help solve conflict, help conflict resolution in primate groups and so on. There's one explanation. Now, I've written two books about this. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's not an evolutionary model that best explains that. But it is a model. It's a way to, it's a testable hypothesis. So when we solve all that, and everybody's pretty satisfied with why emotions are there, why people love one another, attachment and so on, then what? Well, we're left with poetry and aesthetic appreciation of sunsets or something like that. Well, even there, you see where I'm going. It seems to me you're still filling gaps and wanting to evoke the God hypothesis for something, and I just don't see any reason to do that. It's just okay to say we don't know this yet. We're not quite sure what consciousness is. We don't need to say God gave us consciousness. Let's just say we're not sure yet. We have three or four theories, and we're going to test those.
So I want to make sure that I don't leave with a misunderstanding. I certainly wasn't implying that we need God to understand love or appreciation for poetry or for music. I was really only trying to say that this is an analog activity that human beings are happy to pursue without invoking the scientific method and the scientific approach. Now, you could, of course, invoke it, but it would be far less satisfying to do that in lots and lots of situations that we are very happy to be involved in, like personal relationships. I don't think we want to invoke biochemistry and neurology and understanding our personal relationships. We just want to do that the way human beings have always done that, on the basis of love and understanding and all these emotions. So I'm not saying that we need God to understand those things. I was trying to use it as an analogy to say there are lots of things that we value that, in fact, we don't want to look at just from a scientific point of view. And if you're willing to accept that, then why not be willing to accept that there's something else called faith, called religion, that you would also be willing to look at without appealing to a scientific investigation to understand it and think that it's valuable to do so?
Because specific claims are made about the deity that he, gender, whatever, is omniscient, omnipotent, answers prayers, creates things, creates genomes and life forms and universes. These are very specific claims made. At some point, if you believe in God, you just really have to believe that the deity sticks his finger into the cosmic ointment and stirs it up and does things, stirs up the particles, somehow interacts with our world. If he doesn't interact with our world, then what is he? Just a deistic prime mover, maybe, a first cause. I mean, I'd be willing to go along with that, if I suppose, but it still seems like a gap filler to me. Why not just say, we don't know how the universe got created. Maybe Hawking and those guys will figure this out. But, you know, maybe not. We'll just see how it goes. But why invoke some deity that does it? At some point, if you believe in God, you just have to believe that he's coming in and entering our world. And if he's entering our world, isn't he doing it in some measurable way? And now we're back to the natural world.
You wrote a book, you reminded me as we began just conversing up here about atheists, not only, but atheists, and our first crossing was, I reviewed that book in the Post. I've been looking for that review for a year, and I haven't been able to find it.
I haven't.
And it's a funny thing. Authors remember book reviews much more plainly than the reviewers remember.
Yeah.
But everyone. But one of the points you made in that was even about the variety of beliefs among atheists. And I wish you'd expand on that just a little bit.
Well, this is how we believe, and Michael's review, he accused me of scientism, to which I hold up as a badge of honor, or almost scientism. And you wrote this final little paragraph about how I'm a free rider. I'm free to do whatever I want, because I don't believe in God. Well, at first I thought, yeah, I'm a free rider. But then I thought, well, no, actually I'm not. I mean, I really have a lot of social and moral and personal obligations to family members and friends and my colleagues and so on. I can't just do anything I want. So we all answer to somebody. But in terms of atheism, yes, well, okay. I guess I make distinction, as I did in the opening comment about our Templeton question here, a distinction between belief and God, that is, I would say, as a statement about the universe, agnosticism, I suppose, would have to be the right phrase or the right term. I once saw a bumper sticker that said, militant agnostic. I don't know and you don't either. And I guess maybe that's my position currently. The strong atheist position, I believe there is no God, I think is untenable. Weak atheism, just lack of a belief in God, that's perfectly fine. Indefensible, I think. So there's, varieties of these. And, of course, once we start down the road of talking about different approaches, Dawkins' approach versus Harris's approach versus my approach, whatever, that's just a marketing question. What's the best way to market an idea? That's not really an empirical question in terms of what we're addressing here. So, for me, the larger and more important thing is, since I don't think we're going to change everybody's minds one way or the other, to have a pluralistic society, you need some set of rules by which we can get along and believe radically different things. And therefore, I do believe separation of church and state. And the American experiment seems to be working pretty good so far on that question, as long as we build up that wall, Mr. Jefferson, as Hitchens likes to say, keep that wall up and strong.
Any comments?
Well, I'm certainly a strong believer in separation of church and state. I think that when they get too mixed up, it's bad for the church and it's bad for the state. So I'll go along with that. That doesn't mean that one shouldn't allow one's religious perspectives to inform one's political perspectives, but that would be true of any moral or ethical perspective that you had. You would want it to inform your political perspective. So I'm pretty sure we will agree on that.
Do you think it's a little bit odd that those who study evolution closely now argue so much about cooperation and even love for one another and in general altruistic views, which it's in the course of science, no doubt this happens, which is so strongly opposed to that earlier interpretation of Darwin that it was all the jungle and the survival of the fittest and so forth?
Yeah, it's a great question, because I think one of the reasons so many Americans don't accept evolution is because they equate it with nature red in tooth and claw, and it just means we're brute, nasty, selfish, greedy animals and nothing more. And it was not okay from, say, World War I through the 70s to apply an evolutionary model to explain why we're nice, why people are nice to one another. The reason it wasn't was because Darwinism had become equated with eugenics and social Darwinism and Nazism and so forth, and Ben Stein wants to revitalize that ridiculous notion as if that's what all evolutionary biologists think. Well, the last 20 years, thanks starting with E.O. Wilson in 1976, it's now okay to apply evolutionary thinking to why we're a social primate species who is often altruistic, cooperative, pro-social, and so on. That's just a sort of a history of science issue. I don't think there's any religious or scientific reasons why not to do it. I think it was just politically why it wasn't okay. But now it's okay. And I think the science is fairly far along now. We have a really good understanding of conflict resolution in primate species and why we have to be fairly nice to one another most of the time in order to get along. And actually the Templeton Foundation has funded much of this research on sort of the good qualities, the virtues of humanity, which have long been lacking in the scientific studies.
What do you think about the niceness or oddness of the fact that science has here taken a turn which makes rather more sense of the commandment to love one another? It's not a description, it's not a law, what we do all the time, but it is a suggestion that we should look in that direction for something very creative for building societies, building communities, mm-hmm. building nations, and so forth. Is this a case in which it was useful to have the Bible reflected on critically as a guide to thinking or as a stimulus to thinking?
Yeah, I think my take on that is that we evolved these moral emotions, what Adam Smith called the moral sentiments, long before there was religion, as hunter-gatherers, you know, hundreds of thousands of years before civilization. And long about 5,000 to 7,000 years ago, populations just got too large. Tribes and bands and tribes coalesced into chiefdoms and states such that these informal means of conflict resolution didn't work. Too many opportunities for defecting on the rules and cheating and so on. And so we needed some sort of formalized institution to codify the rules of getting along. And those two institutions were government and religion. So it's not that all governments are bad and all, like libertarians think, or all religions are bad like atheists think. In fact, I think religions and governments have experimented now for 6,000 years, and they have a fairly refined and fairly good accurate view of human nature. And so the list of sins, I think, fairly accurately reflects our human nature, simply by trial and error. And 4,000 years of rabbinical debate, it was not for naught. I mean, it produced a lot of useful information that we can now start testing.
What about the rabbinical view that the significance of there being a creator is that it means everything has been understood in its detail, and the text that you brought out, everything is good, that everything is good? I mean, it seems to me there's two fruitful lessons in there. Alfred North Whitehead said that without the first, there would be no such thing as modern science. Without 5,500 years of instruction in the intelligibility of all things, and that might mean a lot of sacrifice and a lot of asceticism to find it all out, and a lot of years to find out as much as we could. But it was a worthwhile effort, even if you yourself kept running into brick walls. You know, so my question is this another... I'll lead it into a more practical direction, maybe. As I remember in your book, and I maybe misremember it, as I remember at least one of the lessons I learned in it, I believe there was a scene at Chartres.
Yes.
If I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And you used that as a way of describing the awe and the kind of gratitude you felt. And you went on to say that, if I remember right, something like 70% of all people who call themselves atheists or actually believed in the power of intelligence in all things, a kind of unified field theory, or whatever you want to call it, and that there's a certain dovetailing with religious views.
I think the idea that the universe is rational, or at least it behaves in a way we can understand it. It's one of those curious things why mathematics seems to match so well with the actual physical universe. Yet another sort of one of those gaps that we don't fully understand, but it's an interesting problem. I think more to your point, that science and religion have evolved together historically in mostly cooperative ways. Yes, there's conflicts, and many of these stories are highly exaggerated. Galileo and the Church, for example, have sort of come down to us in cardboard potted stories of good and evil, and it just wasn't that way. I mean, much of modern science comes out of certain religious traditions with Aquinas, from Augustine to Aquinas and so forth. But that's just a kind of an interesting historical sidelight. On some level with science, we want to know how the world actually is, regardless of how we came to ask the question in the first place, bottom line.
Yeah, but think about mind a little bit. Mind doesn't only ask questions about how to, but why? Why do we have these abilities? Why do we think they're worth pursuing? And why is there anything at all? It's a different sort of question.
Yes. Well, I'm sure we can resolve this one today. But why not ask, why should there be nothing? Maybe something is the default state of the universe, and nothing would be really weird, and we'd have a hard time explaining why there would be nothing. Well, we wouldn't be here to explain it, I suppose, but we just assume this. I mean, this is one of those Mysterian kind of mysteries that I think may not be resolvable, like free will and determinism. I mean, if the universe is determined, how can you be free? Why even bother writing about it, which everybody does because you have to? But at some point, it depends on how you define free will and how you define determinism, and what do you mean by the universe and a first cause and something versus nothing? These are just words.
You know, I wonder, I'm going to turn to you in just a second, but you mentioned a while ago that humans existed long before there was religion. If you mean Judaism and Christianity, yes. Religion, I'm skeptical, as far as I can see, as far back as there are human beings. In fact, the anomaly is atheism. Even today in the world, I think, as according to the Encyclopedia Britannica, out of 6 point some billion people on Earth, if I remember right, 250 million, some number like that, are atheists. And certainly in history, that seems to be the truth.
If I could only get all of them to subscribe to Skeptic, 250 million. Wow.
In addition.
Yes, obviously we have some impulse toward religiosity, yeah. But that doesn't mean there's a God.
No, it doesn't. But it suggests something about human self-reflection that is not quite satisfied with. How-to questions are awfully important. Mm-hmm. And civilization doesn't begin unless you do that. But it is very important for people to go on to have meaning in their lives, too, and to see a purpose in it and a point in it. Yeah, my own view is this is a practical weakness of atheism in the world, for most people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're a very scientifically trained and so on person, perhaps not. Tocqueville made the same point. Philosophers can lead you to the Ten Commandments. You don't need the God of the Hebrews for that. On the other hand, having there 10 points that everybody can remember is very useful politically. And, anyway.
The shadow of enforcement, it's called.
Well, there's so many incredibly deep questions to address here. One hardly knows where to start. These huge questions, why is there something rather than nothing? Why do we ask questions like that? You know, what's the evolutionary advantage in asking questions like that? Now, I don't want to say that because there are such questions that seem to be so imponderable that this means there must be a deity. No, that would just be, as you've pointed out, another extension of the God of the Gaps, which I certainly don't buy into. But nevertheless, these are huge questions, and they point to a kind of spirituality about human beings that is, perhaps from your point of view, accounts for why so many people have a religious point of view, and make me wonder whether the reason why there is this tendency isn't because there is, in fact, a God, and this was the way God wanted us to be. But let me make perfectly clear, I do not believe that science is ever going to prove the existence of God, nor do I believe that science is ever going to disprove the existence of God. In answer to an earlier question of yours about how God might work in the world, I do believe that God does work in the world. I'm not a deist, I'm a theist. I do believe that God works in the world, but I have this hunch that God chooses to do this in such a way as to make it undetectable. Now, of course, that's a really easy thing to say because it basically wipes away all possible ways of testing it scientifically. But remember, my original thesis is that that belief in God is not a scientific question. Now, you might say, well, how are you going to account for all that stuff? Well, there's a number of ways, and I admit, I don't know how God does it. But, for example, let's say there were such a thing as miracles. I'm doubtful, but let's say that there were. Science is about reproducible stuff. And if you've got some singular event that you don't reproduce, any good scientist is going to say, oh, unreliable data, let's just throw that out, and we'll go with all the stuff that we can reproduce every time we do it. So it's not logically impossible that there could be some irreproducible events that would have been reported as miracles. I don't know. But there's lots of other ways in which these kinds of things might happen. Physicists know that there's almost nothing that's impossible. There are things that are really, really improbable, but they're not really impossible according to the laws of physics. Laws of physics are, well, except for some really tiny issues that we won't go into, are time reversible. But, you know, we never see a glass dropped onto a concrete floor reassemble itself and popped up. But it's not impossible. It's really, really unlikely. Now, again, I don't know that that's the way things happen and that miracles that are reported in the Bible. I suspect that really what happened was that stories got embellished over time and these things don't really represent miracles, floating axe heads and the sun stopping during a battle that Joshua took part in. But on the other hand, I do believe that God affects our, shall I use the term, souls. Okay, and you would probably want to use the term brains. Okay, but I think there's a distinction. But how could that happen? Well, we know that according to our understanding of classical chaos, that extremely small changes in initial conditions could result in macroscopic changes in results. And we know quantum mechanically that such really tiny differences in initial conditions could never, even in principle, be predicted and understood from measurement because of the fact that it's below the quantum radar, the uncertainty principle. So, from what I know about physics, it's not impossible to imagine a world in which God acts, but we never can prove it.
Then what's the difference between an invisible God and a non-existent God?
Well, for you, none. But for me, I claim that I can feel God's presence in my life. And you're going to say, oh, it's just, you know, what you ate last night.
Well,
and and I can't give you a scientific argument against that. It's a belief. Some people have said, look, if you could prove God, what would be the use of faith?
What would you say about the idea that anything you can show by science cannot be God? Because it would be bound by space and time and matter.
That was my first statement. There is nothing that science could prove that would satisfy what most people who believe in God mean by God, something outside of space and time. So, Bill, if you want to say, I believe there's an entity outside of space and time that affects the world somehow, or whatever it is he does. Okay, well, I mean, it's sort of, in a way, it's kind of the end of the conversation. There's not much more to say about that. I believe it, I don't. You believe it, I don't. Okay, well, now what? Let's go, you know, have a beer or something. I mean, again, back to these words, the soul, what is the soul? Well, gosh, I mean, on a slightly less controversial subject, let's say when cosmologists talk about dark energy and dark matter, to explain why galaxies are structured in a certain way and they rotate a certain way, and there's not enough matter that we can see, so therefore we have to evoke this concept of dark energy and dark matter to explain it. That's not an answer, and they don't mean it to be an answer. It's just a linguistic placeholder for we don't know what it is, and that's the beginning of research. But when religious folks invoke things like the soul or a miracle or whatever, or in the case of intelligent design, it was an intelligent designer. That's the end of the the quest. It's like, that's the answer. The story is over. We don't have to think about it anymore. Go ahead.
So the problem here is that you're thinking, quite legitimately, that the whole question is about whether or not God exists. But for me, that's not what the question is about at all. I already have an answer to that. It's not a scientific answer. My question is, what does God want me to do? That's what the whole fabric, the whole activity of my faith is about, is trying to figure out how I should do the kinds of things that God wants me to do. Now, I'm sure that that, in a very different language, occupies a lot of your life as well. How should I act so as to spread the maximum amount of good in the world? Because I think you're a good person, and that's probably what you want to do. And I'm not saying that you don't do it well. I suspect you do it very well. I'm quite sure that I wouldn't do it as well if I didn't have faith. I'm not sure that that's true for you. But for me, that's what it's about, is trying to figure out what God wants me to do. The scientific question, it's not a scientific question.
Okay, fair enough. But how do you know what he wants you to do? Do you talk to him? Do you pray and you listen for that small voice? Do you look for cues in the environment that, oh, I see that happened, so he wants me to do that? Or an impulse comes to you, I should donate to Oxfam or World Vision or whatever, because why?
Yeah, all those things. And the other thing that I find to be particularly helpful is that I talk it over with other people who have a similar perspective about God. Now, I'm sure that's the way it works for you too.
Right. So why? Yeah. Well, sort of. Yes, Dawkins and Hitchens and I were just talking about this the other day. What should we do about this disaster relief? Yeah, well, so speaking of which, to push another hot button, if God is acting in the world, why isn't he in China and Southeast Asia and Darfur and so on? If he's acting in the world, what's with that? I mean, he seems to have missed the boat on a few important things here.
Well, look, you know, this is a question about which we are certainly not going to find the answer today any more than we are to the one about why there's something rather than nothing. People have been struggling with the issue of, if God is good, why is there evil in the world, since long before Job was written, but I don't think much progress has been made since Job, and we still study Job, and we still come up with perhaps a clearer understanding of what the questions are, but no clearer understanding of what the answers are. But my answer to that is, what God expects us to do is to do everything we can to relieve the suffering of those people.
You know, I think the problem of evil is a really interesting one in itself. Already in the 12th century, Maimonides and Aquinas had written about the fact that if you wanted a world of freedom, in which freedom is possible, you're going to have a world of contingency. And if you have a world of contingency, you're going to have a world in which bad things happen. And nonetheless, this meets the whole design of building a world of freedom. But I don't think we should go on that way. I think what we should do is face the question here, is, does science make belief in God obsolete? The question is not, does God make Judaism and Christianity obsolete, but belief in God obsolete. And I don't think we should take belief in God here in a tone of voice different from belief in atoms or any other such phenomenon. In other words, let's just stay in the realm of the natural, not jump to the world of the supernatural. Is there evidence in the way we live in the world, and have human beings seen this, that suggests, yes, there is, a force for mind and a force for good and so forth, more than meets the eye at whatever level of science we have attained.
Oh, certainly. Here I diverge quite far from my fellow atheists. I think religion is a great force for good, probably maybe even slightly more good than evil, but anyway, who's counting? I mean, religious people give more money, they donate more, and so forth. But that's what, in a way, religion is privatized social help. And I think one reason Americans are more religious than Europeans is Europe has a fairly well-developed safety net to help poor people and people in need. And so you don't really need religion if the government's doing it. If the government's not doing it, you kind of need religion to do that. I think religion does it better than government. So
I would say religion is actually a socialized form of private help.
Yeah, I agree.
It gives
it
you all kinds of encouragement
and
to do it.
The private sphere is more efficient. So.
Well, I'd like to sort of address your question, even though I've already said that I don't like its premise, because basically what you've asked us, I think, is there objective evidence that would support belief in God, given our modern scientific understanding? And I've said, I hope, clearly enough, that I don't think that's a proper basis for a belief in God, and isn't the basis for my belief in God. But having said that, there's an awful lot out there that would make a reasonable person say, looks like something's going on. So let me give a couple of examples. Fred Hoyle, a 20th century cosmologist and an atheist, and a great believer in what was called the steady state theory of the universe. The universe has always been, always will be, in pretty much the same way, was just appalled by this ridiculous theory of the Big Bang, and in fact called it the Big Bang derisively. And one of the reasons, I believe, why he didn't like it was because it sounded too much like creation. But in the end, the evidence built up, and he had to accept it. And for some people, Hoyle carefully looked at the universe and said, from his position as an atheist, it looks like it's a put-up job. And, I don't think it ever made him into a believer, but he was honest about the fact that it just looks like a put-up job. Now, other people have taken that. So there's a philosopher named Anthony Flew, and he has recently written a book called There Is a God, in which it says there is no God, and the no's been crossed out, because he styles himself as being the world's most famous atheist. Well, obviously, getting religion didn't bring him any humility, but... but it's not. He freely says this is deism, this is not theism. But nevertheless, what he was saying was that scientific evidence convinced him that he should believe in God. Now, like I said, that's not where I'm coming from. But let me also say that where some people, maybe the intelligent design people and the creationists, have looked at the world and said, look at all this wonderful complexity. There must be something behind that. I take a very different point of view. I look at the world and say, look at all this marvelous simplicity. There must be behind that. So I have a very different view of that, but I don't find that to be solid evidence, not the kind of thing that would allow you to write a physical review letter saying that I've found proof for God. On the other hand, it's awfully suggestive.
Good. I guess one of my intellectual heroes is Martin Gardner, who is, sort of the skeptic, who is himself, though, a believer of sorts. He calls himself a fideist. It's sort of a William Jamesian version of certain things it's okay to believe in if they are big questions that are ultimately unanswerable and they're important to me, which way I believe, it's okay to just go with whatever works for you. It's a pragmatism thing. So Martin, for example, Gardner says, I believe in God, I'm a fideist. And he prays. He says, I think the atheists have slightly better arguments than the theists, but nevertheless, he says, it's a close call, so I'm going to go with what makes me feel good. So I respect that, and I respect Martin a lot for that. But, of course, we're off the page of science there, and we're into the psychology of belief, which is interesting, but it's still getting away from the empirical question.
No, but I think you're missing a third alternative here, which is a perfectly reasonable, natural view of the signs of the presence of God in the world in which we live, which the vast majority of human beings have been led to. You know, I don't think it's likely that they're entirely wrong. How that happens, why that happens, I'm not so sure, but it keeps reemerging. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are thinkers who have put a good deal of work in this, Jewish and Christian and Islamic conspicuously, and have ways of talking about this that are really quite interesting. This reminds me, what tipped this off in my mind is Steven Pinker's opening sentence when he answered the same question. He said, "Does science make belief in God obsolete? Yes. If by science we mean the entire enterprise of secular reason and knowledge, including history and philosophy, not just people with test tubes and white lab coats." That's a very expansive definition of science. And, you know, I think you can show without too much difficulty that there are lots of philosophers, historians too, who just raise other questions besides scientific questions and who are not satisfied with pragmatism as an answer. But they're not necessarily Jews or Christians. I would call something like that faith. That's a different matter from the knowledge that there is God.
Okay, here's what I think about the power of belief. I think the way it normally works is that we come to our beliefs, not just religious beliefs, political attitudes, social attitudes, economic beliefs, and so on. First comes the belief. Second comes the justification for it, the rational reasons, the arguments for, and so on. And that we're raised to believe a certain thing, our culture sort of dictates the way we believe it, our cohort, our colleagues, our mentors, and so forth. And then we back into it with, when we're asked, why do you believe? Okay, I have to give some good reasons here. And so we do. We concoct good reasons. So when I say this, I'm not just picking on religion. All of us do this for all of our political, social attitudes and so forth. And the confirmation bias kicks in. You look for and find confirmatory evidence for that belief system. You ignore the disconfirmatory evidence. Conservatives do it. Liberals do it. Theists do it. Atheists do it. We all do it. And so that complicates it by the fact that the number one predictor of anybody's religious beliefs is where they happen to be born. Which to me goes a long ways to saying, well, this really looks like, you say, looks like a put-up job. It looks like the whole belief in God system of a belief and religion is a put-up job by culture, by history, by circumstances.
Is that true? I mean, take any culture you want. And for the vast, longest time of human history, people believed in God. They weren't, you know, they weren't Jews or Christians or Buddhists or Hindus. I'm willing to say there are traditions which nourish a way of thinking and a set of habits that are diverse. But there's also free movement between those. Maybe not such big fractions do, but rather remarkable. And especially Judaism and Christianity make the appeal to reason to think about that.
Mm-hmm. They do. Well, I think part of it is that the way belief systems work. I think our brains evolved to infer design and top-down controls or top-down formations of things. The idea of self-organized emergent properties like evolution are counterintuitive. This is why intelligent design, I think, got legs. It's such a great marketing term. Everybody gets it just like that. You don't have to know anything about biology. It looks and wings look like they were designed to fly. Eyes look like they were designed to see. There must be a designer. It's a simple argument. It fits intuitively with our kind of folk science brains, how we evolved. That's why science is so counterintuitive. All of quantum physics is counterintuitive. Global general relativity, completely counterintuitive. Yet, we accept those simply because the evidence is there. So I think often we have to combat our intuitive way of thinking. Sometimes it's right, sometimes...
So maybe physicists are wired a little bit differently, but, I mean, what you say is true. We do tend to see order where there is none. That's why there are constellations. You know, the stars are randomly distributed in the sky, and yet we see constellations. But let me return to this idea that the thing that really impresses physicists is not the complexity, but the simplicity. And you just, again and again, and the historical development of physics has always been in this direction as well, you encounter this idea that, and this fact, that the more you learn about things, it seems like the less you need to know in order to figure out why things are the way they are. Why would that be? And that's just really astounding. But let me say something about belief, too, because in general, I have to agree with you that... Look, the reason that I'm a Christian, the reason I'm a Methodist, is because I was born into a Christian Methodist family. But What about all those people who were born to... I wish Francis Collins was here. So I'm sure you've read Francis's book, okay? So he's born into an agnostic family, and as he goes along, he becomes a determined atheist. And at some point in his life, he becomes a Christian. Now, how did that happen? I don't think it follows your model. I don't think it follows a model of deciding what the belief is and then coming up with the evidence. And it certainly wasn't true for Anthony Flew. He had a really firm belief in atheism, and the evidence led him toward deism.
Yeah, the Flew case is slightly complicated by the fact that somebody else wrote that book, and he had a ghostwriter. Well, not a ghostwriter, he was on the cover. We think he kind of got pushed toward that, although I'll give him credit for a deism, whatever that means. I mean, it's sort of innocuous. Case of Collins, he had a personal experience. I mean, he says in the book that he was out in nature and the waterfall and so forth, and he had an epiphany. And what does that mean? I don't know. I mean, maybe he had a temporal lobe seizure. there's lots of ways to try to explain these things. I don't think it needs to be explained. People have interesting, anomalous psychological experiences that they attribute to all sorts of things. It's as interesting as all get out, but I don't know what you really need to infer from that.
It's not just personal, though. It's intersubjective. I mean, there's centuries of thinking about these things. And so when he makes the flu, makes this step, if he did, that's not just an anomalous, odd step. That step's been made by lots of people over time. I'm not going to start down that line, but you see the point.
Yeah, I see the point. I my answer would be, these are all good reasons to believe if you already believe. These are good arguments to bolster faith that you already have. If you don't have the faith, the arguments I don't think are going to sway you. Yes, okay, occasionally this happens in the case of Flew maybe, and Collins for sure, I guess. Collins rested it on two what I just would call gaps. Immanuel Kant's The Starry Heavens Above and the Inner Law Within. Well, I already explained where the inner law within comes from our evolutionary heritage as social primate species, and the starry heavens above, that is the fine-tunedness of the universe and all that. Well, Steven Weinberg, referring to simplicity, he thinks that maybe there's just a really simple underlying principle that explains all of these odd configurations and the fine-tunedness and this and that and the other. And who am I to judge? He has a Nobel Prize, you have a Nobel Prize, so you two fight it out. But that's what he thinks.
I have been delinquent in not turning to all of you earlier, but I just thought it was so engaging. I didn't know where to interrupt. So may I just turn over to you and see if there are questions? Yo. that was a four-way tie. Yes, sir. Microphones are coming. So. No, it's to him first, and then to you, and then here, and then over here.
The God we're talking about is a personal God.
Yep.
That's the one we're worth talking about. I think Bill has already answered my question. My question is really to Michael. If God were to reveal himself to you, what would he or she have to do to make you say, I believe in God?
Good question. What would God have to do to convince me? Well, Pace Woody Allen, a large cash deposit in a Swiss Army, Swiss bank account under my name, and I'll even give you the figure, $10 million will do it. That'll cover it. Well, my serious answer is the one I opened with. I can't conceive of anything that I wouldn't, as a psychologist, for example, think, well, I wonder if I was having a temporal lobe seizure like Constantine probably did and Joan of Arc. I wonder if maybe I just had an anomalous sleep paralysis experience like the alien abductees have. I would probably doubt myself because I know too much about how people come to their beliefs as a social scientist. So I'm not sure there's anything that would do it because, as as I said, if we encountered an extraterrestrial that could make cells and whatnot and life forms, I'd think, well, that's it. It's just a technology.
Maybe I could just add to that. You could also ask the question, what would it take me to give up my... There is nothing, and that's why it's not a scientific question. If it were, if it were a scientific question, I could define what experiment, what observation would make me abandon that hypothesis. But I contend it's not a scientific question, and there's nothing. At least I hope there's nothing. I mean, who really knows?
All right. It's a half comment, half question, which is that there's something troubling to me about this discussion, that it seems that it's sort of centering around the question, does science make belief in Zeus obsolete, as opposed to does science make belief in God obsolete, which to me is, you know, one answer to that question is the Zeus thing is a very contentious question, but the God thing is obviously no to me. I don't know, that's my impression of it. And so I guess that's my way of saying it. It seems to me that science, there's this idea, and even within this conversation, that there are these two sort of competing worldviews between religion and science, and that they're sort of of equal weight, and we're at this crossroads where they're apparently contradictory, and we don't know exactly which belief system to pursue. Whereas I think that if you were to talk to somebody who has a certain spiritual sophistication, they rather would regard science as sort of, you know, like a baseball game where you kind of go and you enjoy watching it and you enjoy following it, but when all is said and done, it's really just not that meaningful. It's meaningful in terms of metaphor, maybe, but not that meaningful, which is another way of saying they kind of see science like a primitive religion. And if you were to talk to somebody who's spiritually sophisticated, the reason that they would say that's the case is because science is sort of the pursuit of truth through the understanding and the exploration of the physical world. And to a spiritual person, the physical world is the most superficial aspect of our beings and of our lives. And so when you talk about these, I guess, more inherent concepts that are spiritual concepts, you talk about like explaining things like love or truth or God or things of that nature, beauty, meaning. A spiritual person thinks that that's an intrinsic part of the postulate rather than the theorem.
Yeah, I think it has to do with how you define this word spiritualism, and I think obviously anybody can find spirituality in any number of ways. Religion doesn't have a monopoly on that, and for me, it just means a form of transcendence, that is the awareness on a deep intellectual and emotional level that there's something grander than me. And although religion can do that, as can a number of New Age beliefs, I think science does that in spades. In terms of making us feel humble about our place in the cosmos and how lucky we are to be here, I think science gives us the grandest story of all time. And if I were religious, I would embrace science at every possible moment as the best tool ever devised for revealing that spiritual nature of the cosmos.
Amen.
Amen. Amen, brother. Okay.
No, I certainly agree with that, because the wonder is just magnificent. And but also I agree with what Matthew said about the kind of God that science might be making obsolete.
Doesn't believe in God, what is that superpower that who is running why people are suffering in third world, why people are doing great in the U.S., or why so many poor people in India, so rich people in India, what kind of people are there everywhere in the world, including here. So because they must be paying for the crimes or pride they have committed, or they have done something bad in their past life or today, because so many people believe hell and heaven is right here on this earth, because you can see one person is suffering right in front of our eyes, another person is enjoying life. Why is happening all this?
So many people still believing, I mean, still believe in hell, except they locate it here with global warming. may I please up here, the young lady. There it is.
I'm Sally Quinn from the Washington Post. I have a website called On Faith that I co-moderate with John Meacham, Newsweek editor John Meacham. And for the last year and a half, I've sat in on many of these discussions. Hitchens, I have to say, is more amusing
than anybody.
He's quite funny, but with science versus religion, and in the end, I always walk away thinking, what you, Michael, said about the person with the bumper sticker is, I don't know, and you don't either, and. Sometimes I wonder whether these discussions are worthwhile, because in the end, I don't know, and you don't either. I mean, I'd love to hear both of you on that question.
Can I say a word first, but I'll turn to them immediately. Agnosticism is what you're saying, and you can pretend to be an agnostic. But when you live, you're going to live either as a believer or an unbeliever at certain places. Not at all.
If one calls oneself an agnostic.
Well, it's not a matter of calling oneself, but if you take that bumper sticker seriously,
yeah.
You don't know and I don't know either. Still, we have to get from now until tonight, and from tonight until tomorrow, and the next day, and for a whole life. And there you're making choices by the way you live. You're showing what you believe by the way you live. So, while I'm not promoting agnosticism or atheism, for that matter, belief in saying this, I call the subtitle of my own book The Dark Night of the Believer and the Atheist, or The Atheist and the Believer. We are in the dark, but that isn't that we're without signals. You know, I would like to close and ask each of them to make a final comment, Bill and Michael. But I'd like to close with this. Some unresolved questions in what we said are, what is mind? What do we really mean by mind? What do we really mean by science? And what do we really mean by God? I have a feeling that Michael tends to think of God in terms of intelligence, mainly, designer, etc. And it's important to see, if you're trying to see is there a God, it's rather important to begin to get some idea of what it is you're looking for. But anyway, all these questions are underlying our discussion. And would have to be made. You're not going to solve this problem without drinking a case of brandy together. would you?
Right. Thank you. I don't know, and you don't either. Absolutely right on a certain level. I don't know, and it's not like I'm without my doubts, but I'm comfortable with those doubts. At the same time, what do we mean by know? There are ways in which we know things scientifically, and there are ways in which we know things spiritually, emotionally, and they're not the same kind of knowing. So even such a simple statement as, I don't know, isn't so obvious what that means. What is mind? What is God? What is science? Well, I think science is the easiest one to describe. It's a way of knowing things that we pretty much agree about what the rules are for it.
Instrument or worldview?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Michael described it a bit earlier as pretty much a worldview.
Yeah.
A substitute for religion, or a better alternative to religion.
Mm.
And I'm not quite ready to go there.
No,
I'd be willing to say, I'd be be willing to say it's a tremendous instrument, and it's of extreme importance to and utility to religion.
Okay, so I'm going to go with it's a great instrument. It's a great way of learning about the natural world, and it's useful to religion as it's useful to lots of other activities in human life. Mind, boy, I haven't a clue. It's we use it in a way that distinguishes it from brain. And part of it is because of the fact that we haven't a clue what consciousness is. Now, Michael suggests that maybe we have a little problem with consciousness. No, we have a huge problem with consciousness. Now, that doesn't mean that automatically because we don't understand something that we have to resort to religion to understand it, but we're very, very far away from understanding consciousness, or for that matter, free will. So I don't have a clue what mind is. What is God? God is love.
Well, Sally, I hate to have you write yourself out of a column or a blog, but well, what's the point? Well, I mean, gosh, I think you'd have to be made out of wood to not be interested in these questions. I mean, these are the biggest, most interesting questions there are. And regardless of how you come out on it, it's good to at least have thought about it, whatever you end up answering. I pretty much said what I had to say in 2000 in my book, How We Believe, and then Science of Good and Evil, and the morality question, which we're not really addressing here. I have been kind of amazed that this whole thing has taken off, starting particularly with Dawkins' book, Harris first, but Dawkins, 1.5 million copies of The God Delusion in America. It's unbelievable. It's a market indicator of something happening that wasn't there before. Richard and I have the same literary agent, and John Brockman, who told me he shopped that book around in the late 90s and couldn't sell it. No one wanted it. They thought there'd be no market for it. But, 7 years of Bush and the war and evangelical right, so we can speculate on different cultural things that would make a book popular at one time and not another. But in any case, here it is, and we're talking about it, and I think it's great fun, not to mention important.
I don't know who the other 500,000 were, but I know at least 1 million preachers who read it and started writing books and sermons.
Yes, right. The Dawkins Delusion. Anyway, it's all good. Atheism is atheism and agnosticism. It isn't even a thing to be. It isn't. It's just a starting point. It's like a default position that you build upon. There's no positive set of like planks that these are the six things we believe in as atheists or whatever. Something else has to fill that in. So secular humanism or humanism, the American Humanist Association is here today. And well, anyway, so liberal democracy, or you believe in this kind of economic form, or people should help one another, whatever. These are things that really have nothing to do with atheism or agnosticism. Okay, mind, I think it's just an emergent property of neural firings and patterns. I think it's a self-organized emergent property that we'll come to understand from the bottom up through neuroscience. It's just a word. It's like dark matter. It's just mind is just a word. It isn't anything. It's just a word to describe behaviors that people do and thoughts that they think. And we just have to refine and get rid of the word and refine it as something else in very objectively described patterns of behaviors and thought, something like that. Science mostly an instrument, although those of us that spin off from that something like a worldview are in search of something else, I think, not really science, but probably secular humanism or something to build upon to fill the gap that we don't have. I mean, in that sense, I sort of miss not being religious, only to the extent that I'm a social being like everybody else, and I like to have friends and family and people that I like to hang around with. So I hang around scientists and secularists and so on, just because that's what we all do. And so whatever you fill that in with, it's probably not, it's not really science, it's something else. And then God, I think, is just the ultimate source of explanation for that we evoke, that I just don't have a need for, and I understand why lots of people do, and I think it's an interesting question why we fill in certain gaps with that concept, but I don't think there is anything like a God.
I think we really need to close, but there has to be a Parthian shot. Will you allow me? What if God is not an explanation? What if there's another way entirely of thinking? But anyway, I really want to thank all of you for being so patient with us, but I really enjoyed the discussion. Very happy to meet Bill. I never met before. Happy to meet Michael. I never met before, but you continue with your the quality of that book, and I'm very happy I praised it then, not only because I had to meet you face to face, but because I said the good things about it. Thank you all very much. Thanks to the Templeton Foundation. Thanks to Henry Olson at AEI for setting this up. Thank you.